Imagine learning in a small group, intimate setting while exploring unique European locations. EU VetCE Experiences offers race-approved CE seminars that combine half-day lectures with time to relax and discover captivating cultures. The CE sessions are delivered in English, allowing you to elevate your career while vacationing with loved ones. Experience the perfect blend of learning and luxury at EU VetCE Experiences interactive seminars in hand-picked European destinations. Elevate your knowledge and recharge simultaneously. Visit euveterinaryce.com to learn more.
Having the four-year veterinary degree is not necessarily a job. Say, here, now, here's your job, but it's a way to get a job.
Welcome to Vet Life Reimagined. Now, Dr. Candace Sousa has a unique story about the time she became determined to be a veterinarian, which she shares in this episode. But when Dr. Candace entered veterinary school at UC Davis in the 1970s, the admissions board was still skeptical of women's ability to do the job they envisioned for veterinarians. Nevertheless, the 1970s was a new era for the veterinary teaching hospital at UC Davis, as it opened their brand new clinic and was the nation's first primary, secondary, and tertiary animal care center at a vet school. They were growing their specialty practices. The residency program began with 7 residents, and by the 1980s, the program enrolled 60 residents in 19 specialties. This is relevant for Dr. Candace because after she quickly found out general small animal practice wasn't for her, she went to specialize in dermatology. She tried many different things in her career. Some were a fit and some were not. So she learned to find her North Star. Eventually, she was recruited to work with what is now known as Zoetis, where she worked for over 13 years and was on the forefront of very relevant medications we use today, like Apoquil and Cytopoint. She even offers a very helpful framework about the best way to think when considering a new medication. Dr. Candace has a lot of wisdom to share, so let's get to the conversation. But as I was kind of looking at your background, I found an interview that you did 10 years ago, and in that interview, wow, they actually asked you to predict. What did you predict for veterinary medicine in 10 years? So we will come back to that, and I'm curious.
Oh my gosh, I don't even remember doing that.
See your reaction to your predictions, but let's start all the way at the beginning. And when did you know you even wanted to get into veterinary medicine?
Okay, well, so you first have to start and realize that I'm really a baby boomer. I was born in 1951. So that's, you know, your parents and things like that. So the idea of being a veterinarian back in those days was very different than what it is now. My extended family had dairy farms up in the Northern California area, and I'd love to go and visit the dairies and visit, play with the baby calves. And I really, really looked up to my aunt, who was the manager of this farm. Her husband had passed. And so here was in the 50s, a woman hiring milkers and running a dairy, which is a 365-day-a-year job. And I always liked science. So I was kind of looking at animals and science in my life and thought I might be a nurse or something like that. And then when I was 12 years old, I had 2 younger sisters, 11 and 8 at the time. We had a dachshund. He lived outside. Who would have thought a dachshund lives outside in the mid-50s, right? But in San Francisco, it's cold. So my parents were at work one day. We were inside. We gave him a bath and we were just watching TV. And all of a sudden, the dachshund jumped up and grabbed my mother's parakeet and started running around the house with a parakeet. And my sister's sort of screaming. I'm going, ah. So I chased the dog, cornered him, got the bird, little birds like panting. I go, and now what do you do? Okay, what do you do? So we wrapped him with toilet paper, kind of covered him up, and then walked him 2 blocks away to the pet store and said, what should we do? And they go, well, I don't know. So we brought him back home, laid him in the cage and sat on the couch like this, waiting for my parents to come home. Well, needless to say, the bird died, but I felt so helpless. You know, what do you do? I was 12 years old. I said, you know, I'd like to be a veterinarian. And I started reading books about veterinarians. There's one called Circus Doctor. And my mother, who was just a high school graduate, a housewife, she worked at JCPenney, said, well, you know, that's dumb for a girl to be a veterinarian. And we don't support that. Well, that as a kid says, well, I'm going to do that then, right? So that became my focus, and it helped me. I called it the North Star. You know, you always have like a goal, but you kind of vary and veer. But I kind of said, okay, I'll be a veterinarian, and then I'm going to go to Davis. My parents never went to college. I had no idea Davis could have been on the moon, but I knew that's where the veterinary school was. That's the only college I applied to, and I luckily got in. And everything kind of led to becoming a veterinarian. At the time, that then became the early 1970s, when women were not common in veterinary medicine. And matter of fact, I do remember in my interview, they had started interviewing about 2 years before that. And they asked you questions like, why do you want to be a veterinarian? And one of the things was, well, what will you do when you have children? And I said, well, I don't know. I guess I'll still work. I mean, nowadays you could never ask that question, right? Let alone think about it. But it just, to my mind, you just could do it all. And that was, again, in the 70s when women were just starting to think about doing it all. Fortunately, I got into veterinary school, liked it. During veterinary school, married my husband, who was a lawyer. And I said, where lawyers work, there aren't many herds. I better change my focus. So instead of being food animal and production, I went into companion animal medicine and kind of went from there. And everything has kind of been building on itself from there. So there's the long answer to your very short question about my journey. But now I look back and I see now that it's unusual for men to become veterinarians. To see the number of women, it very much is a female-dominated profession right now. There's no doubt we can see the statistics. And my opinion about that is based on the fact two things. First of all, it's the kind of job that you can do part-time if you want to have a family. You can work, you know, half days or a couple days a week. And the reason a lot of men don't go into it now is because it doesn't pay like other professions. You go to a four-year professional school, you get a good salary, but if you went to a four-year medical school or dental school or law school, the options for money are much more. So I think that money drives a lot of our choices, plus flexibility. The other thing is now that more practices are becoming corporate, it's easy for a woman to get a job rather than own a business. Back in the 60s and 70s, you had to actually own a business. And that wasn't a common thing for a woman to do too. So it's really, the profession look has changed a lot in the 50 years I've been thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, actually, what you said brings up a couple of things that I wanted to ask you about. And back to that interview that I mentioned, one of the hardest things about veterinary medicine that you said, and this article was from 2013. At the time, you said the hardest thing about veterinary medicine for you was around that business ownership aspect. So you went into a private practice, small animal, and you did own your own practice as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Eventually. It wasn't the very first thing I did. Yes.
It was actually after you became a dermatologist. Is that when you?
Yes. I was in my residency. I was working with a woman, a friend of mine who owned a business. This practice, I'll say around the corner, down the street, wasn't very far away, had been owned by two brothers. And it was actually the first small animal practice built in Sacramento. It's called Sacramento Animal Hospital. And they were going to retire. So my friend and I bought the practice from them. And then I started working there. And again, it wasn't very far from the other practice. But I worked there. And then I hired other veterinarians to work there for me. But, you know, I didn't get as much satisfaction out of the daily business where, you know, we ran out of this drug, this client bounced a check, this one needs an employee review, we got to plan the Christmas party, the light bulbs burned out, we were, you know, all that stuff. I just wanted to be a veterinarian. And those were the days, again, too, that was even in the early 80s, when you didn't really have practice managers. You usually had a senior receptionist or a technician. Many male business owners had a wife who would do that stuff. And I would come into my off day, was a day off, and I would balance the books and employee review and all that other stuff to do. And I thought, this, you know, it's not that much fun. You know, I don't want to do that. So eventually I was able to sell the practice to the two women we had hired. I said, look, if you're ever going to own a practice, buy this one, because the day you own it, clients won't know any different. You've already got a staff. You know how the thing runs. And we were able to transition. And then I did my dermatology only as an independent contractor out of that same building. I said, look, do you want me to stay? I'm happy to stay. Or I go someplace else. I said, no. So I'm in my little office and did my derm. I had a separate phone line and things. And So it worked out very nicely that when all of a sudden they ran out of a drug or something, I said, see you later.
Not my problem.
3 in the morning, I don't have to go in and check out what's going on. Why did, you know, did a piece of paper fall in front of the alarm and it, you know, the alarm went off. There you were never robbed. It's just you always had to get up in the middle of the night and go back to the practice. So yeah, that's what happened there. So I had the opportunity to see it, but it just wasn't a passion of mine.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about dermatology as well. So you mentioned that you are already one of the few women going into veterinary medicine, and then you ended up specializing. So what sparked your interest into specializing into dermatology?
When I was in veterinary school, I think it's like when you're anything in life, all of a sudden, like my aunt who owned the dairy, you kind of find a person that sparks your interest in something. And Tony Stannard was a professor at UC Davis, and he taught dermatology. And he was so interesting and made it really sound fun. And immunology was on the cusp of being invented, I guess I'll say. When I was in veterinary school, all we had were lymphocytes and antibodies, right? Then all of a sudden there's T and B cells, and then there's more and more. So they were just then in the early 80s looking at autoimmune diseases. And I found immunology very interesting. Also, Don Lowe, if you're familiar with he was urologist Finko and Lowe. He was the dean at the school. And Don talked one day, says, you know, as a woman, dermatology would be a great profession. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I thought when I was in practice in the beginning, I knew a little bit about a lot of things. I mean, I could amputate a leg, I could do a cystotomy, I could, you know, but I'd like to know a little bit more about one thing. And so that's why I chose dermatology. At the time, all of the residencies were in universities and there were only 5 of them. And because my husband's a lawyer, I had to apply to Davis because we couldn't move out of state, you know, Cornell or anything. And I didn't get accepted. And so that's a problem. But again, I'm the kind of person, don't tell me no, mom, I'm going to find a way. And so I talked to Dr. Stannard and said, is there a way we can develop an alternative residency program? And another woman who was in the Bay Area who also liked dermatology, Susan Reinke, her husband was a surgeon, wanted to do something in derm. So we created an alternative residency. And what we did for the first year and a half is Susan and I split a position and had no money. So I would go to the university 2 days or 3 days a week, see cases. I was a resident, but I was not getting any money for it. But that's the only way you can take the quiz at the end is to do a residency. By the time we had done a year and a half, they decided that they would take Susan and I as a resident. So we split a salary for the last year. So it was 2.5 years. And then I was able to take the exam. But what I would tell people is if you have a North Star, you can find a way. And you know, these alternate ways. Now there are lots of private practice residencies and alternate residencies and people who visit places and things have developed. But we were the first ones to do that. And Tony took the time, along with Peter Erke, to contact the College of Dermatology, say, we'd like to develop this program. Will you approve it? And they did. So at one point, we actually had 4 of us at UC Davis, 2 paid residents for the 2 positions, and then Susan and I doing the volunteer or unpaid positions. Again, it got me where I wanted to go.
Yeah. So I think you're right. I think when you are determined and you really have your North Star, you can definitely find ways of getting there. Did you have any mentors or people that you found as support when you were going through a lot of that?
We would like to thank our sponsor, VetBadger, the all-in-one practice management software that puts relationships first. Created by working veterinary parents, VetBadger provides all the communication, team workflow, and medical management tools you need to run an efficient practice and get home to the relationships that matter most. In support of parents in VetMed, VetBadger will be offering a signed copy of the book, Pregnancy and Postpartum Considerations for the Veterinary Team, by Emily Singler, to everyone who registers for a demo between Mother's Day, May 12th, and Father's Day, June 16th. To register, visit vetbadger.com and find the link in the description below.
Well, my husband was definitely a support. I mean, we've been married now for 48 years. He stuck with me through this whole thing. when I was studying for the boards, as a matter of fact, the kids were 3 and 5 years old. And so I would work a half day on a Saturday and then stay at the practice and study. And Bill would often take the girls that weekend, say, up to Lake Tahoe or away, so I would have time to study. So he was always very, very supportive. And so that was very helpful. I mean, he, you know, it was a good partnership there. I found that there weren't really so much mentors, but people I could emulate. There wasn't an official thing. But he said, well, I like what this person's doing. How do you do it? How do you get there? And you just kind of emulate them. But I've offered and tried to mentor some pre-veterinary students and giving them some real guidance. And there's been whole things of kids in college that are wanting to become veterinarians and how do you think about it? And I think sometimes now, and this is just maybe my old lady perspective, a lot of kids, my grandchildren included, don't have that gumption. They kind of wait for it to come and they don't go out and get it. And that's where we have such a good opportunity to do things nowadays, to make things happen. When I went to college as an undergraduate, my parents, I was the oldest of three girls, they had no money. So I applied for every single scholarship there was, you know, from any thing, and got scholarship money. And my parents didn't have to pay for the first year. Now, obviously, college is more expensive nowadays. But at the time, you know, you had your room and board and your tuition, your books and the scholarships. And I worked because I knew I needed money. So I worked during college. I worked during veterinary school because not expecting that it would happen. So I think we have to help teach our children and our grandchildren to own their own fate and to find a way and not expect it to be given to you. You know, you have to find a way. No, as far as mentors, not necessarily, but just, I think part of it was my personality being the firstborn, that always helps too. You know, your firstborn children are always like those kind of kids anyway. But yeah, anyway, that's where it went. So I was pretty lucky, I think.
I'm a first child as well. So the oldest sibling, there's something about
exactly.
We make it work. And I think that's great. And I think I also read that you actually were able to leave veterinary school without a lot of financial debt. And
exactly.
Schools are a little bit more expensive now. And a lot of people are leaving vet school with quite a bit of debt. But kind of back to what you said, even with the debt, there are ways of getting to the ultimate goal, your North Star as well. And we have other episodes to talk about finances, but I think you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons for this podcast too is being, first of all, curious and looking at your options, but two, it is, don't wait for someone to necessarily offer it to you to go and find it. So I love that message. And in fact, again, when I was reading this interview of yours, they asked you if you had to go all the way back to the beginning and do it all over again, would you go back into veterinary medicine? And your answer was yes. And the reason that you really liked veterinary medicine was the diversity of options and paths in veterinary medicine. Is that still your answer today? And if so, what are some other things that you've noticed about veterinary medicine in the diversity of career paths?
Back in the 70s, there was sort of this hierarchy pyramid. I think that everybody looked at the faculty of a university was the top of the pile. You know, they were like, you know, the gods. And then they, and then you looked at if you were a specialist and you were in a private practice, well, that was still pretty good. And then maybe you were a general practitioner, maybe in companion animal. And then maybe you did everything. You were sort of the country vet that did the cow, birthed the cow. You were Dr. Pohl or something. You did everything. And after that, then the careers that you had didn't look like they were very exciting. In other words, you could be a military veterinarian. You could be work for industry. You could be a meat inspector, but things that didn't have a lot of panache or they didn't look good. Yet they're so important. And so with your veterinary degree, you can go into research. You can work for a human hospital. There's people that do that and do research in human medicine. that you look at people who've worked on HIV. I mean, Nels Petersen and his work in cats has helped so much with HIV. So it, having the four-year veterinary degree is not necessarily a job. Say, here, now, here's your job. But it's a way to get a job.
Yes, absolutely. Back to, you were talking about, like, you saw professors as kind of like the ultimate of ultimate career paths. And you did actually teach for a while. So, you know, we talked about you being in clinic and you eventually go into industry, you do all this research. So what, let's kind of go back to your career path here. How did you go from the clinics to university? Like, what was kind of your path there?
Well, when I was in practice in Sacramento, both Peter Erke and Tony Standard, who were the faculty at UC Davis at the time, would have a sabbatical. So they say, would you come do a sabbatical replacement? So I would go to the university and assume their position at the university for a year, year and a half or whatever. I didn't enjoy it, though, because, again, it's sort of like that business thing. I enjoyed interacting with clients and treating animals. And as a faculty member, it would start with the students. You probably remember, you'd take the history and develop a thought. And then the resident would come in and sort of oversee everything and guide them. And then you open the door and here comes the professor. Oh, yes. Very good. Very good. Carry on. Carry on. I was going crazy. I was so bored because I didn't have any power and I didn't have my own cases. And so I didn't enjoy that part of it. And the other thing that was very funny is that, again, this wasn't my career, so it didn't matter that much, but a lot of your job reviews were done based on student reviews. And being the person I am and having very little time in dermatology, of 2 weeks in dermatology, right? I know what you need to know. So I would want to say things, okay, come in tomorrow at 7:30, or we're going to work over lunch, or we're going to do it. And the students, once they're seniors, they're sitting back going, gosh, it's Friday afternoon. We have to stay. And so your reviews wouldn't be great. And I go, I'm not going to, pardon me, kiss someone's ass just to get a good review. This is your 2 weeks. And so that part of the job too was like, oh, come on, you guys. I don't want to be your best friend. I'm here like a parent to help you and teach you. So those things about the university were not as exciting to me. When I taught up at Washington State, they were volunteer students. So I'd go, and if you want to come, come, if not. So they were all there anxious. And it was very fun with lots of questions. And they would come, it would be like in the evening, and they would come with their own animals. And that was fun, seeing those light bulbs. But at the university itself, when people are saying, I'd much rather be a surgeon with all this equipment and ophthalmology with, you know, gonioscopes and all the other stuff you've got, or echocardiograms, instead it's his derm, how boring. And, you know, when can we go? So that wasn't as rewarding. So I never wanted to be on a faculty because I didn't want to have to do that. I wanted to treat animals and actually teach students.
Yeah. I think that's such a good moral of the story, though, because just because something culturally has a reputation, it does not mean that it is right for you or it has to be your your ideal. So I think that's such a good observation and realistic that follow your own path. You know, you have to live your life.
Honest, at least. Yeah. I'm at the point in my life now where I can at least be honest.
Yes, good.
Ruffles and feathers, but okay.
No, that's good. So university as a career, not for you. Eventually, you do go into industry as well. So what was the transition like into industry? Like what attracted you to it and kind of what was the initial start getting into that part of your career?
Well, this is a job that found me versus the other way around. I was very happy in my general practice, again, as an independent contractor, going in a couple days a week, doing that stuff, doing occasional lectures, a few things like that. And one day I got a phone call from a headhunter. Gentleman said, Pfizer Animal Health is looking to create a team of specialists. Do you know anybody who'd be interested in dermatology? I said, well, you might contact Gail Kunkel at Florida. I think she's going to retire. And I gave him a couple of names and it was interesting. And that's all I knew. And I came home and told my husband about it. He goes, well, they weren't asking you about it. They were asking if you wanted. I go, really? What is this? I don't know. So about 3 or 4 months later, this guy calls back again and says, well, we have been unsuccessful in hiring anybody. Would you be interested? I said, well, what is the job? I don't want to sell drugs. Again, my passion was animals and their owners. And we're creating a team of 5 specialists to educate veterinarians. And it would include education about some of the products. And I said, well, I guess I could, it sounded interesting. Could you come for an interview? So I went for an interview and they said, well, when can you start? I go, well, I don't know. Then what's your exit strategy? Well, I don't really have one. I'm an independent contractor. I guess I could just in 6 or 8 weeks, just kind of not see new cases and shut it down. Like, okay, fine. So I got hired and it was one of the luckiest things I ever did. I would have never sought it out. And now at Zoetis, which used to be Pfizer Animal Health, there are lots and lots of specialists. There's 5 dermatologists now. And it's so exciting to be able to go into a clinic, see some of their cases. Again, it's like teaching the students was, but yet they're interested. And teaching their technicians and making them use their technicians. And I used to leave there just on a high, like, oh, wow, I've made a difference. I've helped more animals. I'm not just giving a man a fish, I'm teaching them to fish. And it really energized me, that type of position. Plus, Pfizer at the time knew they were working on new drugs for allergy, which I didn't know at the time. So I was fortunate after about the first 10 years. Well, there's this product called Equel. I go, what is this? I knew nothing about Janus kinases. I had to educate myself. I then educated the veterinarians who worked for Zoetis, worked with the research and development people on their clinical trials. It was so exciting. And then Cytopoint. Oh my gosh, another fabulous product. What's a monoclonal antibody? I had to relearn this stuff. So it's kept me educated because about stuff that's new and being able to bring it to not just the animals and their owners, but to the veterinary profession. So that's where industry came. And then in 2016, my older daughter said, who lives in London, she's a professor at the London School of Economics. She said, well, I'm going to have a second child. Can you come for 3 weeks this summer and watch the baby? And I go, well, I guess I could retire now. I'm 65. And sure. So that's when I announced my retirement so I could be more Nona. So I went there. And so that's, again, another piece of my career, my puzzle. But since then, I've still been able to lecture and do a little bit of writing and teaching and stuff. So I'm able to kind of balance it along with trips to Egypt and other things like that now.
Well, that's really exciting. And you were really on the front of medications that are crucial to how we practice now. So, I mean, you mentioned it a little bit, but how was that like? I mean, were people open to new medications? What was kind of that adventure of, you know, being on that forefront of some of these really key things that we use daily now?
Well, there are several different audiences. First of all, you've got the general practitioners, right, who just want a medication that will work. Some are very early adopters. You know, you can give them a bottle of blue pills and they'll say, okay, where do I use it? How do I use it? Others are wait and see. What are the adverse events? I don't know anything about this. I'm not going to do it. So educating them. Then you have the dermatologists who in the beginning are always threatened. Oh my gosh, if there's Apoquel, I'll lose all my business, right? Mm-hmm. You should only sell to dermatologists. They thought the same thing about blood allergy testing. Oh my gosh, if there's blood allergy testing, we'll lose all our business. Well, no, there's always going to be animals who need help and it hasn't hurt anything there. Then you've got pet owners. What is this thing? And you know yourself, when there's new medication for you for something, you're what is this? What are the side effects and that kind of stuff? So educating them about the diseases, because back in the 70s, we thought allergy was all IgE, mast cell, and histamine. That's what we were taught. It's inhaled allergy, and that's what happens. Well, now that's not what allergy is, right? It's more contact. It's the barrier. It's lymphocytes releasing cytokines. There's all these things that go into it. So you have to kind of educate on the pathophysiology of a disease and how the drugs fit in there. Same thing happened when we got our first NSAIDs. I remember when I used to send a fax, if you remember those, yes, over to England to order carprofen, which was Rimadyl, which we didn't have here, but we would get it into our practice by sending a fax. And having an NSAID that worked for dogs was, again, a miracle. You know, there's been lots of sort of miracle drugs that have happened. But it's been very rewarding to see the benefits that animals and their owners have gotten from these medications. It hasn't affected dermatology business one iota. I mean, it takes you 3 or 4 weeks to get in to see a dermatologist. They're busier than ever, but we're helping more animals now. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said about, you know, just the different reactions. You have your early adopters, and then you have some of these that are a little more resistant. And I think both of these are important, like the reactions are important to talk about. Veterinary medicine, we're known as adverse to change. So what are your thoughts? Because, I mean, nowadays, things are changing so fast. Think about AI and technology. And so what are your take homes, your pieces of advice when these changes come into the way we practice? How should we approach these?
Even now, if you look at look at the isoxazolines, the class of parasiticides for fleas, right? So there's one, maybe one's out, maybe it's NexGard, and then we get Bravecto, and then we get Simparica, and then we get Credelio. Why would I change from NexGard to Credelio? I'm very happy with NexGard. Why do I change? So I think that we have to spend time looking at unfortunately, the marketing messages, because when medications are invented or developed, they're not just developed for any particular reason. They're developed because there's a niche and a need. And maybe it was like Bravecto said, well, here we've got a product that's every 3 months. Oh, maybe that's what I want. Maybe that'll make it easier for clients, or maybe it'll make it harder for clients. But looking at the reasons for these things. But whenever I personally look at any medication, I ask 4 questions. So again, here's a bottle of liquid, and it's, you know, God's best medicine. Okay, we'll call it that. So number one, is it effective? Is it going to treat whatever we're looking to treat? Number two, is it safe? I don't care things like a morphine are great for pain, right? Are they safe? We got to look at the efficacy, safety. Then I look at what I call ease of administration. Is it something that has to be injected 4 times a day? Is it a pill once a month? It doesn't matter how good it is or how safe it is if you can't use it or give it. And then the fourth thing I say is, how much does it cost? Some things are very effective. Let's look at Cytopoint. Very effective, very safe, very easy. Maybe some clients can't afford it. But a lot of veterinarians put cost number one. You'll say, I've got a new isoxazoline, and it's going to cost, you know, 3 cents a day. Whoa, I'm going to get that without looking at the efficacy or safety or administration. So as veterinarians, we don't like to hear the word no, and we're so cost sensitive to our clients that we're reluctant sometimes to talk about something. Maybe a TPLO is the best surgery for this animal. It's going to be effective, 90%, let's say. Is it going to be safe? 90%. Is it easy to do? Well, we know how to do it. We have all the equipment. And what is it going to cost? Or what are the alternatives? So I think that that's the priority I like to look at for new products. Some veterinarians say, well, I just use prednisone because it's cheap. All right. Is it effective? Yeah. Is it safe? Well, it's got its side effects. Is it easy to give? Well, yeah, but, you know, the dogs pee in the house or whatever, become aggressive. And is it cheap? So they put the cheap first. It is obviously a factor in a client's determination and a veterinarian's determination. But in my mind, it should be the fourth determinant, the tiebreaker in a sense.
Well, and then just understanding your client and listening to the client, like what is the priority for them? They would some of them are probably going to say, I'll pay whatever it is as long as my pet doesn't pee all over my house or, you know. Yeah. So I think it's kind of a team effort with the client too, is, you know.
It is, absolutely. And it takes a lot of time, and veterinarians are so pressed for time. And that's why they need to feel more comfortable about empowering their technicians, especially in dermatology. There's nothing magical about a skin scraping. And yet veterinarians go, oh, get the blades. They want to look like they're doing something. You know, turn that over. You trust your technicians to put in IV catheters and draw blood and to induce anesthesia, to take a radiograph and to do a dentistry. They can educate clients on flea control. You don't have to spend 10 minutes talking about fleas or how to do a diet trial. Your technicians can do that too. You just have to feel comfortable turning it loose.
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, I noticed that you are part of the Ignite team as well, that program is really empowering veterinary technicians and even the front staff as well. I love that program. Mm-hmm. So is that also something you've really enjoyed recently as well, as helping teach with the Ignite program?
So Ignite, for those who may not know, is an online platform similar to what you might have had with VIN, but different. It's based on a Facebook type of a platform. So you can search things very easily and pictures can be put up very easily. And there are, probably about a dozen specialists that run a portal. So we have surgeons, radiologists, internists, pharmacologists, nutritionists, dentists, it's myself, a dermatologist. So let's say you have a case, you can put it on the Ignite case and say, I just saw this 5-year-old dog with blah, blah, blah. Maybe pictures or not. Here's the blood work. What do you think? And not only do I provide my input, but the 8,000 veterinarians who are there can provide their input too. Now, unfortunately, there's a lot of lurkers. Out of 8,000 veterinarians, you probably get like 3 people that respond, but you can also learn and you can also search. You can say, gosh, what do they say on Ignite about the use of ketoconazole? So you can put ketoconazole, and so it's very usable. Well, there's other portals, one for CSRs and some for technicians. So a CSR might put a question up about how do I handle clients who ask me about flea products? And so you can give them information too. And again, it's all part of what I talked about in the beginning about wanting to help veterinarians help their clients. So it's indirectly me helping. It's providing some good stuff. Or when I see something that I've seen in the past and can say, yes, I think this is it. And people, well, that's great. Or where do you go? So I don't always want to be the one that's, you know, the only answer. I want my other veterinarians there who have experience to talk about things too. Because there's things that I've been out of practice now for 15 years and I've never done fovea light. I don't know anything about fovea. I know what I've read, but I've never used it. Can't tell you if it works or not, but you know, the rest of you can tell me how you're using it and if it's working for you.
Yeah. I love the community aspect of something like that as well. And that is a special part of veterinary medicine. I feel that we have a very good community overall. It's a small and close profession. And so when you are able to surround yourself with colleagues that can be supportive, at least I enjoy it.
So my question to you,
yes,
how do I encourage more people to speak up? I don't like to do quizzes because then people think, well, I'm going to be wrong, right? I don't want to, even if it's a multiple choice, I don't want to be wrong. So how's the way to get people off of the lurkers and to actually share? Because you'll see that you've had 200 looks in one comment. How do I engage these? How do I get these people to engage?
Well, that's a good question. I hadn't figured out. I think I would be farther than I am. But, you know, just listening to a lot of people about community, and this is something maybe part of our veterinary medicine as well that I've heard, is that this field attracts high achievers. And so I think we are very nervous about being wrong or looking stupid. Yeah. I think, yeah. And now that's a human trait. Nobody likes
to. No, I 100% agree, 100%.
Mm-hmm. But I think that may be part of it. And I think there's also some imposter syndrome where we forget how much we know and how much we can support each other, even if it's sharing an experience or a case that mm-hmm. we have seen. Mm-hmm. And I see it, I see it in myself, you know, in other specialists, no matter where you are in this profession, I have seen examples of imposter syndrome where you, it's like you went to vet school for 4 years, you know more than the pet owner on most things. Yes, there's some Google savvy people out there, but ultimately you spent a lot of your life you know, in this field, you know, you can be confident. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's even more intimidating sometimes when you are around your colleagues, because, you know, you know that a lot of them went through similar things as well. So, you know, even if it's just, does anybody have a case like this? And that way it's not, I'm not quizzing you on an answer or anything like that. You're just a case, which is something, you know, that I think is a little more neutral to start. But, you know, other than that, just making sure that we strive so hard to create cultures that are kind and supportive, where there isn't a stupid question, that, you know, you never make somebody feel less than, or, you know, and that takes time and it takes multiple time points. I love how Brené Brown uses an example of her daughter that comes home from school and she's been mortified. And so she gets her daughter to explain what was going on. And apparently she told a friend a secret. And the next thing, the whole class knows the secret. And so her heart is broken. And so her mom talks about building these little pieces of trust. And it's like putting in a marble each time you start to build these little instances of trust. So it doesn't have to be huge. It's this accumulation of little acts of trust. And you build up this marble jar. And I think that's part of it for our community as well. It's having any type of opportunity where we can say, oh, that was such a good question. I had that too, you know, or, you know, those kinds of things start to add up to you making this really good community where we can feel a little bit more comfortable sharing our experiences, asking questions. So I don't know if that was a great answer, but some of the things I think of.
I agree with you. And the other thing I'm doing right now is somebody may post a like the other day, our parasitologist said, here's a fecal from a llama. How many parasites do you see? I was the first one to jump in. I think, well, I say, oh, I think I see two. I mean, there were three, but I was wrong. But I'm throwing myself out there. There'll be a radiograph, and I'll say, I think this, because I'm willing to say, look, if I can put it out there as a dermatologist and not be right, maybe you'll feel comfortable doing it too. So I'm just kind of leading the way with, like, well, all right, here we go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's good too. It is just to even speak up in areas where you're not the expert. And I don't know if I would be wrong intentionally, but, you know, just not be afraid.
I was saying I only see two and there was a third. I still don't know where it is. But I know, I think I definitely saw two, but that was it. So, yeah. So again, I agree that if I can just stick my neck out there, and then there was something, then the parasitologist said, she said, well, I'm sure if you showed me a derm picture, I'd be wrong. And so we're trying to see that even as the experts, we're willing to have conversations and give our best opinions and go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I would feel more comfortable if I saw, and I know that kind of sounds weird, but, or kind of mean, but when you see someone that you admire or see as very, very smart, get something wrong, you're like, oh, they're not perfect.
I know. And it's okay to be wrong. Exactly. Right. You know, so I've at least done that to say, look, I'm willing to put myself out there.
Yeah. My goodness, time has flown. So before I forget, I do want to go back to what I was saying on that interview that you did in 2013. They asked you, where do you see vet med in 10 years? So that was 2013. What do you know? It's 2023. So it's been exactly 10 years. And you said small drop-in well pet care clinics with a few centers for more extensive diagnostics and therapies. So I want to know, what do you think about your prediction? And where do you see veterinary medicine going now?
I still would love to see that. You know, they have that in human medicine, right? Because each clinic now goes about buying all the expensive equipment and trying to handle everything. And I think that's what adds to our cost. And well, pet care, things sort of a lot of like the Banfield model to a certain extent, where you can have everything taken care of, but then have your specialties and your more complicated things in one location. I think it will help of clients with money. I'm not seeing it happen yet. A lot of the corporate things, like, you know, VCA still have a lot of standalone clinics. They don't, they're not merged into one. And clients actually do get a little bit, I don't know if the word's lazy, but they don't really want to go an extra half mile this direction. They want everything right there. Where in human medicine, we have to do that, right? I take my dad 45 minutes to get his iron infusion on the other side of town. So let you do it. But I'd still like to see that happen. Whether it will happen, I don't know. So I don't know where we'll be in another 10 years, but I think that the cost of veterinary medicine now to the clients is becoming so high. We've got to find ways to take care of animals, not just our pets, but our food animals and everything else with a more reasonable cost. Otherwise, you know, animals will be euthanized or won't get the kind of care they need. And, you know, we won't be one of the most respected professions as we have been. We'll just look to be money grubbers.
That's a very interesting observation. Yeah, that's kind of scary. Yeah. But no, I think it's very, very good point. Well, I want to just kind of open it up to you as well. What are some pieces of advice or words of wisdom that you would like to leave the veterinary profession?
Burnout is a problem because we take that one negative comment so to heart that we don't pay attention to the 10 positive things, or we have a fussy day with our staff and that just weighs on us. Try to keep that called the North Star in your sights. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? And focus and spend more time on the good things. I mean, when we have a client who complains, we go home and that's the first thing we talk about, this client. We forget about the 10 clients who sent you flowers when you had to euthanize their animal or something. So appreciate the benefit of what you're doing for clients and their pets or their farm animals or whomever, or the zoo animals, and use each day as an opportunity. And if it's not working for you, look at something else you can do within that same skill set, whether it be going to industry, whether that is opening your own practice, whether it's being a mobile veterinarian, going to research, whatever it might be, but still use the skill set you have, but find a way to make it fit. Like I said, university wasn't my fit. Owning a practice wasn't my fit. Gen referral practice was. Teaching is. So you find that you keep trying things, dip your toe in the water and find things so that you don't get that burnout and just say, forget it. I'm not going to do anything.
Love that. Well, thank you so much for sharing. I want to wrap up with just a couple final questions. And one that I like to ask people is, do you have a hidden skill or interest?
A hidden skill?
Yeah, maybe one that not as many people know about.
Blah, blah. I don't think so. I mean, there's things I do, but I mean, I try to learn foreign language. I know a little Italian now. I speak Spanish a little bit. I tried to play the guitar. I read. I'm in a book club. I love to read. I'm playing tennis again, which I think is really fun. But those are not skills. They're just kind of like things.
Hobbies.
A little bit of sewing. I used to sew all my clothes. What else? That's about it. Yeah, gardening. I like to garden and weed. And yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. So I guess I'm going to throw in a different one because it was something that I actually did write down. You talked about how the volume, the number of hours that you worked, and you really said it didn't, you know, whether you were in the clinic or outside the clinic, you worked a lot of hours. But you also, you mentioned your daughters, you still are able to do all of these activities and have a wonderful, thriving family. How did you do that? Like, how were you able to do so much? And you're so lovely. You have, you know, all this experience and wisdom to share and energy. What is your advice when it comes to, I'm really passionate about my career, being a veterinarian and doing all these things. I also have a lot of other interests and I want to be there for my family. What's your wisdom there?
Wisdom. Small bites. Small bites and lists. I used to love the bulleted lists and then crossing off. And sometimes you did something, it wasn't on the list, you'd write it so you could write it off.
Yes.
So, I mean, a big bite would be like, I want to become a dermatologist. And you're like, but looking at it in the pieces and every day is a piece and not to get overwhelmed. you know, every day with children, if anybody has children, you realize it's not like looking at the 18-year-old thing. It's like, what do I do today when this child has a runny nose, or the school calls, they've canceled school because the teacher, whatever. Small bites, and each thing at one thing at a time, that sort of thing. But lists are very satisfying to me. You know, you can, when you cross out, I did these things, even though the list never goes away, you add to the bottom, but you rewrite it and it's all pretty from the, you start at the beginning again. I'm a paper calendar kind of a girl. I have a, where so I can see things rather than, you know, people using smartphones and calendars. No, I want to see it, touch it, and be done with it.
Yes. I am definitely one of those that loves to check things off a list. So I definitely.
Yes. It's very rewarding. It's done.
Yes. And the final question is, what is something you are most grateful for?
I'm grateful mostly right now for having good health. I mean, yeah, I don't think we appreciate health, and that's physical and mental. Taking care of your mental health impacts everything, your relationships with other people, your job, your animals. And so taking care of your health is the number one thing. And I'm, you know, you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. With that, the health of my family and my loved ones, you can, your house can burn down, you can whatever, but if you have your health, you know, life is good and you can keep on going. So telling people to take care of yourselves physically and mentally and enjoy life today. Today is called the present. It's a gift. It's a present. You won't have it again. What did I do today? And there's always tomorrow, but evaluate each day because there aren't that many days that we all have.
And that was the end of another episode of Vet Life Reimagined. If you are interested by the generation of women veterinarians when the profession wasn't over 70% women, I highly recommend listening to an earlier episode of Vet Life Reimagined with Dr. Jeannie Bishop. You can also listen to the episode with Dr. Jill Clark, the founder of Ignite, which we talked about in this episode. To catch past and future episodes, be sure to visit our podcast website. The link to the website and other resources for the episode are in the description. Please make sure you click the follow button in your favorite podcast app and check out the episodes over on YouTube. We appreciate all who subscribe, which greatly supports the podcast. Thank you for joining us on this journey of reimagining veterinary life. Until next time, stay curious and dream big.